Om Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitam Ritavarshinim Bhagavatim Ashadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami
Let's start from verse 1 in the chapter 9 and just chant through. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Idan Tute Guhyatamam, Idan Tute Guhyatamam, Pravakshamya. Mianusuyate, pravaksham yanusuyave, jnanam vijnana sahitam, jnanam vijnana sahitam, yajnatva mokshase shubhat, yajnatva mokshase shubhat, rajavidya rajaguhyam, rajavidya rajaguhyam, pavitram idamuttamam, pavitram idamuttamam, Pratyaksha bhagamam dharmyam, Pratyaksha bhagamam dharmyam, Susukham karatum avyayam, Susukham karatum avyayam. I think these last two, I was going to say something more about, I think, from last week. Anybody remember that? Didn't I say that? Okay. Anyway, I'm going to. So. I'll just read Brahmasandhi again for you for verse 2. Rajavidya Rajaguhyam Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyaksha Avagamam Dharmyam Susukam Karatum Avyayam. So here, these first two verses, Bhagavan is really exciting Arjuna about the wonder of this knowledge, the greatness of this knowledge. And so in the second verse, what we saw last week, it's Rajaguhya, it's Rajavidya. This knowledge is the king of all vidyas. It's the final say, actually. And so I talked a lot about that last week. Then Rajaguhyam, it is also the greatest secret, right? For one thing, it's the sot is hidden in the secret itself, so there's no greater hiding place. And also, most things that are, it's also not objectifiable by sense perception or by any of our means of knowledge, and so in that way it's a great secret. And another one is that most things that we have that we keep secret, we have to protect and worry about. But this one, this secret, once gained, where there is no protection necessary. And so that makes it a great secret. It doesn't torture us. It's not a secret that tortures us. Swamiji used the example of even, you know, people who have all of these, have a lot of wealth and have all of this jewelry. They keep the jewelry in a safe and then wear, you know, costume jewelry. They wear imitations because they have to keep that jewelry safe. And so, like that, secrets, you have to protect the secret. But this secret doesn't require any protection because there's nothing that can ever be done to harm it. So that's why it's the king. Nothing can be done to harm it. And that's why it's the greatest secret. Pavitram, it is the purifier. It's also the purifier of purifiers, actually. Because actually the Atma, the self, is the only thing that is completely pure and it's not subject to being tainted. And so knowledge of that self is the greatest purifier because you actually are given that which is pure. You are given the self. Through knowledge, you're given the self which is pure. There isn't anything else that's pure. Everything else is subject to dvaita, you know, subject to duality. It's subject to it's subject to death. It's subject to its shadow. So even the thought, I think one has to, for this pavitram, in terms of yourself, one has to even give up the idea that I'm a good person. You have to realize that you're doing the best that you can, you know, that you're as good as you can be. But nobody can be all good. And that's very humbling. That's something that Jung realized. But we're in Dvaita, we're in duality. And there is no real perfection within duality. And so once you realize that not only are you not completely pure, you never will be in terms of the upadhi, But there is something about you that is absolutely pure, and that is yourself. And that purity is not subject to any type of change or manipulation. You can't even do anything. You cannot make yourself impure. Right? You can't sully yourself. You can't stain yourself. You can't throw the stain of a dharma on yourself. It's not possible. So yourself is free from any type of impurity, nor can anybody do anything about that. And so this jnanam, in fact, is the greatest purifier because it gives you that which is actually pure. Every other type of purity is subject to impurity and has to be maintained. And so you're always having to dance around the attacking impurities, the impurities that are presenting themselves, staining your purity, your so-called purity. So once you realize that about yourself and about it, it kind of allows everybody else to be doing their best also. So it's humbling, true, and also makes you a nicer person to be around, when it's not so pleasing when you are the only pure one in the group. Those are all jokes, Swamiji can talk about it. So we looked at that. And then uttamam pavitram, that which is the most exalted purifier, because it gives you that which is truly pure, which is free from time and free from space, free from duality, free from dharma and adharma, free from birth and death, free from changes, is what it is. Can't be stained. And this knowledge is pratyaksha avagamam. It is something to be recognized immediately, directly, because it is knowledge of yourself. So there's no distance. There's nowhere to go. There's nowhere the knowledge has to travel. It doesn't have to land on anything which is away. It lands on what the knowledge itself lands on, which is that which is the most immediately present, which is yourself. Even any type of perceptions or thoughts, memories, anything that requires any type of objectification, to gain knowledge of that, to gain knowledge of that is going to be a knowledge that you have to get a hold of the object, and then you have to gain knowledge of the object that you've gotten a hold of. And then you have to keep a hold of that object because it's not you. Therefore, it can go away. Therefore, memory is involved, And not only is memory involved, infinite understanding in terms of different perspectives around this knowledge is also involved, because the knowledge takes place in duality of something which is within duality. Yourself isn't within duality. It doesn't have any parts, and it is immediately present. So the knowledge, the self-knowledge, is a knowledge that holds up a mirror to something which is always there and changeless, your very being. And so this protection means immediately present. Avagamam means knowledge. It's a knowledge of that which is, you can say, a knowledge of that which is immediately present. The knowledge itself is aproksha. Means the knowledge itself has to land on what is already here. This knowledge of what is already here. There can't be anything more immediate than that. Already here, not subject to objectification. Right? And that knowledge is dharmyam. So dharmyam means it is the embodiment of dharma. It cannot go against dharma. This knowledge is in keeping with the very nature of the very order of the universe, and it is the very self of the universe. So the knowledge itself, there's no possibility of it going against dharma, because the knowledge is knowledge of what is the very truth, the very essence of dharma, which is the Atma. The Atma is the very being of all that there is. And this creation is an expression of infinite knowledge, right? The Maya Upadhi is infinite knowledge which has the self as its truth, right? And so the knowledge itself is of dharma and everything that dharma stands for, of the essence of dharma. So it's dharmyam, okay? And then it is sukham. Karatum. It is very easy to gain. It's very to do it. Karatum means to do. It's very easy to do this knowledge. Okay? You can do this. It's done very easily. It's gained very easily.
Why? Because unlike any type of action or any type of gain of something that is not me, right? Then I have to do things, something. The subject has to reach the object. The subject has to come into relationship with the object. But here, the object is the subject. Right? And so there is no distance, there's nowhere to go, and there's nothing to do. Because there's no distance between my being and my mind, for instance. All that is required, it's not that there's nothing required, the mumukshutvam is required, which will get you to a teacher, and with that mumukshutvam, your mind is available for this knowledge, and that's the end of it. Your mind, the mumukshutvam is there, which gets you to a teacher, right? Because the mumukshutvam, as the Shastra will say, if the mumukshutvam is there, the teacher will come. The Swamiji says, even if you're in the Timbuktu, remember that? Even if you're in Timbuktu, if the mumukshutvam is there, Bhagawan will get you a teacher. Because it's time. It's just that's the law. So the mumukshutvam is there, yourself is there. Because of the mumukshutvam, your mind is there and available for it. All that's required is the pramana. And so the pramana is there in the form of the teacher. If your mind is there, the self is already there, your mind is there, the teacher is there, now what's there to do?
Listen.
Yeah. And that's the pramana. Right? So that's it. That's why there couldn't really be anything more simple. The only problem is without a person being prepared for this knowledge, then in your mind things are complex. So we were talking about earlier, there's a lot of complexity, you know? You have notions about what it means to become free, or notions about what it means to be liberated, and those notions can be extremely complex and convoluted. But if the mumukshutvam is there, and you even come to the teacher with these extremely convoluted imaginings of what it's going to take for you to be liberated, the teacher will remove all of those. That's part of the teaching, right? Is to remove those types of projections and those type of doubts until those things that you brought to the teacher, just one by one, they just naturally drop off. You know, the teacher doesn't have to, or the student really doesn't really have to worry about them. You know, you just have to be patient. Give the student some time to listen, because those complexities are just built up by the prior experience that you've had. You know, you're a mumukshu. You know, you're surrounded by complexities, people's notions of things, and so you pick up this and pick up this and that idea. But then as things start unwinding, as the pramana takes place and things start unwinding, those things just naturally drop off, you know. I remember when I first really was interested in listening to Swamiji back in 1972 when we went to Rishikesh, when I first went to Rishikesh to, and he was teaching there for a good period of time and enough, and I'd been to some yajnas and things before that, so I had some time to be exposed to the knowledge, enough time to be able to say when he'd taken us to this big bonfire, taken the whole group for a long walk along the banks of the Ganga until we got to this big place where they built this huge bonfire that they set on fire, and we were all sitting around, you know, singing bhajans and whatnot. And I was just talking, had an opportunity for some reason to be talking to Swamiji for a minute, and I said something like, and I was kind of, I just kind of realized this. I said, Swamiji, this knowledge is really simple, isn't it? And he really laughed and he said, that is the whole problem. It's too simple. It is too simple because if you think about it, yourself is here. It's not anywhere else, you know. It is the one that you take to be yourself. When you say I am, I'm exist. When you say I am, that I is landing on you. You who are Brahman. It couldn't be more simple than that. There's adhyasa, the superimposition of the I, which is Brahman, to be mistaken as being a product of this body, you know, to be somehow connected with the body or somehow connected with the mind. But the I that you take yourself to be, it is that very I, that is Brahman. So that very I, when I say I am, this me, I could remove the body from it, I'm still there. The very me that I take to be me, if I say I am the body, the very one I take to be the body, if I remove the body, I would have to say, oh my gosh, I'm still there. It's not the body. I guess I'm not the body, because here I am, that their body's not there. Then you can say, the sense organs. No, I must be my sense organs, but get rid of them. No, oh gee. The I that I've always taken myself to be, is still here without the sense organs. Oh, I'm still here without the mind. Oh, I'm still here without the ahankara. Oh, I'm still here without the universe. This me, the me that I am, right, has been mistakenly identified with the physical body. But the sense of self, when you say, I am, I exist, I'm a conscious being, the me, that is Brahman. It's nobody else. It's Brahman. The problem, the ignorance, is not the samanya jnanam. That's not where the ignorance is. Samanya jnanam means that general recognition of yourself as a conscious being. That one that what the ahankara is labeling, its primary label, like if you say, the primary label would be like this. I am the body, I am the mind, I am the sense organs. I am the body-mind complex. I am a woman, I am a man. What is the primary? I am. Right? And then you lasso all of these things. But the I am is the constant. And so what makes that I am a hankara is only that it identifies with something that is actually experientially objectifiable to you. That's what makes it an ahankara. The I am part is correct. In fact, for jnani, the very I am stays at the ahankara, what we call the ahankara as a thought, the I am thought is there. But instead of landing on this anyonya adyasa, this mutual superimposition of I the body am, right? Now it's I am Brahman. In other words, the I am, instead of lassoing something that you experience, is just there in its own right as limitless as Brahman. Right? So that's the thing. The primary object, which is the subject for the ahankara, right, is Brahman. You are Brahman. That's why in the end, it's not travel to Brahman and see, meet him. You are Brahman. Means the you that you take to be you right now, that you is not the body, mind, sense organ. It is Brahman. And that's all the prakriyas, all of the teaching methodologies are just to make you realize that you, the one that you say is Haso, is Brahman. You can say, Haso is Brahman, but Brahman is free of Haso. You know, I am Brahman, you know, this body is Brahman. But the body is Brahman. But I, who am Brahman, am free of the body. That's why everybody can say that from your own position. You know, you are Brahman. There's nothing here but Brahman. But Brahman is free of this. That's the satyam mitya. That's the thing to be understood. That's how very, very personal this knowledge is. And so it could not be easier. It's just the mind has to unwind. Because we have all kinds of notions. All kinds of notions, even what it means to be an enlightened person and all of this. And even what knowledge, our gain of knowledge is always truly, and rightly so, our gain of knowledge always has to be with the objectifiable, the objectification of something, and then you know that thing, right? Like I see the painting, and I know the painting because I objectify it. Here, yourself is already present. I don't have to have a pramana land on it so that I can know it. It's self-evident. And so we're not used to even thinking in those terms. What I want to know is already here. It's already what I want to know. I need to not re-experience myself. The self itself, the me is already here, that aparoksha jnana, and that direct, immediate presence of me is already totally 100% here. 100%. Not covered at all. Not covered like, oh, if only the clouds moved away from the sun would then shine. I could experience the sun shining. Oh, if my mind was only, you know, more pure. My mind was only pure, you know. Then the radiant bliss of Brahman, you know, would be experienced. That's how what people think. So let's get rid of the clouds so we can have the the experience of me as I really am. You know? And I said, no. Who you really are, the Sat Chit Ananda, all of it, Sat Chit Ananda, is totally present, experientially present, not as an object, but as your conscious being itself, right now. The problem is with the word Ananda. You have to recognize what they mean by Ananda, the Ananda of your, which is your being, which is present right now. Whether you have a sukha-vritti or a dukkha-vritti or whatever type of thought modification you have, that thought modification is illumined by an absolutely present Ananda. That's the thing. So whether you're illumining a sukha-vritti, you know, a vritti of joy or peace, or that's a thought modification, how wonderful those things are, or the hellish vrittis, whatever they are, Ananda, yourself, which is the beloved, which is the most dear, that is absolutely 100% present, you know, to those vrittis. The vrittis don't cover. In this sun analogy, what you have to understand when they say, because people misunderstand this all of the time, you know, we know the sun is up there even though the clouds are obscuring it. The clouds are obscuring the sun. But we know the sun is there. But I need to remove the clouds so that I can really have the experience of the sun. Right? But you are the sun. You are the sun. The sun is its own experience. The sun is not being covered by the clouds. Nor is the luminosity of the sun being dulled by the presence of the clouds. What if it's a huge storm? What if the clouds are pitch black? You know, pitch black, and rain showers are coming. What is happening to the sun? Nothing. But it's illumining the pitch black rain clouds. Though it's not performing a function of illumining, because consciousness is there, luminosity is there, those clouds are illumined. But the sun isn't saying, if it could talk, it's not saying, these clouds are dulling me. These clouds are taking away my luminosity, and I'm not able to experience myself because they're there. It's absolutely not that way. And so this is a matter of viveka. This is a matter of discrimination, to recognize the presence, the beloved nature of myself that is present to whatever the vritti happens to be. But that viveka is... you know, they use the example that for that type of viveka, it's very subtle, because this is nothing but consciousness. And so to make a viveka between satyam and mitya, where the satyam, right, what is actually there, has no distance from the mitya, so they're both in the same time, the same place, that requires discrimination, you know. That's why they use this example of the Hamsa bird, you know, who goes to the little bird bath that's filled with a combination of milk and water. And the Hamsa bird, you know, just puts its little beak into the mix of milk and water and sucks out all the milk and leaves the water. You know? That's viveka. There's two things in the same place at the same time. Yourself. There's no distance between satyam and mitya. There's no distance between your being and these experiences that are wafting through. It's not like consciousness is here and your experience is over here. Then what's in between? Like if consciousness is here and what you experience is over here, then there's a gap. Consciousness isn't reaching it then, right? Therefore, then it's not going to be known. And so no distance at all between you and what you perceive. And so until it's pointed out with a prakriya, with a teaching methodology, until it's pointed out, there's no reason for satyam, the sattva of the sattva of the mitya, means that which reflects consciousness, etc., rajas and tamas. There's no reason for it not to say, I am the conscious being. Because consciousness is never away from it, right? From your mind, consciousness is never away from your mind. Your mind is located in your body, just like a bouncing ball. So it has that problem until it's until it's a means of knowledge is a pramana is, you know, is shown to the mind, and then that knowledge takes place. And so it is not just sukham, it is susukham. Susukham means it is extremely easy. It is extremely easy because there is no distance between the knowledge and yourself. As long as the student is there, as the student in you is there, the one who wants to know is there, and therefore the teacher is there, there's nothing for you to do. You don't have to do any activity. You just have to be present to it. So it's susukham. And one reason it's susukham is it's avyayam. Means the self, the object of the knowledge is avyayam. It never changes. It never transgresses its own nature. Right? It has no parts. You know? It's totally free from parts. Your mind would be hard to know. To understand your mind and all the nooks and crannies of your mind and all of the unconscious material going on there. Why do you have this thought? And why do you have that thought? You know, very difficult because it's infinite. What about understanding the body? Almost impossible. We still don't understand it really. We keep gaining knowledge, but we barely crack the surface. That's Maya. Anything in Maya is like that. Very difficult even to know. Right? Atma is not difficult to know because it's one without a second. It has no parts. So you don't have to know a right side or a left side or a top or a bottom or this aspect of it or that aspect of it. It doesn't have aspects. It doesn't have a top or a bottom or a right or a left. It is only one thing, one non-dual being. And so you either know it or you don't. It doesn't have a back side, doesn't have a front side, doesn't have parts. It is what it is. So you once you recognize it, you recognize it. There's not a second thing there to recognize. Oh, I know this, but I only have a shallow understanding of it. You cannot have a shallow understanding of that which is, I'm talking about Brahman now, a shallow understanding of what is one without a second. Because there aren't any parts and there isn't any depth. Depth means now we're into duality, right? Because we go deeper. How are you going to go deeper into consciousness which is one without a second? There is only consciousness there. See what I mean? So these things have to be understood. That's why they go the susukham, karatum, and then avyayam. Why is it so easy to understand? Because one of the reasons is that it's non-dual. Also, even in understanding the mitya, to understand this is mitya, if the satyam is understood, then this is mitya will be understood. Right? Because you have to understand what mitya is. Mitya has to be defined. But once you understand the very definition of satyam, of the self, and then recognize the self, that which is free from that which is and which is free from change, there is no, within duality, there is no such thing. Right? And there is no such thing, which is Brahman, nor is there anything. There's no such thing, which is Brahman. Nor is there anything to be found. You know? And so, when there is no thing to be found, then the only thing that is there prevails. Right? Do you understand that? It's like here, everything here is. Everything here exists and it is known. But there is no thing here. And so, what the thing is the existence consciousness. Right? Because that is. The existence consciousness is. But you try to find a thing here, and you can't. Because everything is, you know, has a prior non-existence and a posterior non-existence and is infinitely divisible. You can't find any kind of substance here. But the substance which you here is always here, no matter how much you analyze the creation. You see what I mean? Like if I take any object like lamp down, or take a pot down to shards, down to dust, down to molecules, down to quarks, whatever I want to do there. Every time I break something apart, the other thing doesn't really have an existence. It's just a conglomerate. That is an infinite, you know, that will go on infinitely. But as doesn't matter how infinitely far I take it, there is something stable in that process, and that is the existence, which is not touched in any way by that breakdown. So I could say, the pot is. Now the pot is gone, and the shards themselves are. Right? They exist. Pot's gone, but the shards, because it's broken. Now the shards exist. Now it's crashed into dust. Now the dust exists. Now the molecules of the dust that were dust exist. Now the atoms exist. Now the quarks exist. Existence never wavers at all. It never wavers. And existence is the one thing that pervades duality as its very being, but itself can't be objectified to be divided. And so these are all prakriyas, where I just understand that I am the very being that is here. But all of this has to be taught. If yourself has been recognized, then it's easy to teach these other things. If the self hasn't been recognized, it still has object status. Mm. So it's still within duality, right? Mm. And so the other prakriyas can't really work because you haven't recognized, the satyam. You have to recognize the satyam for something to be mitya. Right? That's why there's kind of an order. Whichever prakriya you use, there's an order of, to really understand, you can start with Ishvara. You can start anywhere, but you have to always take it back, Ishvara back or the Jiva back, to what is. And then from what is, we can understand all of this as being dependent on that. But without understanding what is as yourself, that's not possible. So that's why all these teaching methodologies need to be exposed to them. And then when somebody asks you to teach them, then you realize that, I can't say this until I say this. And I can't say this until I say this. And you'll just see that, because it wouldn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't make any sense to the person, because the person starts from here, within the duality. And so here, anyway, you can imagine in this chapter 9, these two verses, Krishna is building up the wonder, the absolute wonder of this knowledge to get Arjuna's attention. And now what he does is tell the what happens to those, how unfortunate for those that don't get it, that aren't mamukshis, that don't want it, that don't have Shraddha. So he says, Ashraddhanah purushaha dharmasyasya parantapa aprapyamam nivartante mrityu samsara vartmani ashraddhanah purushaha dharmasya asya parantapa aprapya mam nivartante mrityu samsara vartmani. So ashraddha danaha purushaha nama tukaro. Purush is people who are ashraddha danaha, who have no faith, have no shraddha. Ashraddha danaha comes from shraddha. It's an adjective too. So purushas, it means to shraddha dana means to have faith, to have shraddha. So purushas, people who don't have any shraddha. For what? Dharmasya asya, for this dharma. Now he's used dharma before, so here what dharma means, actually there's many different meanings for dharma. Here we're meaning that which is the actual essence of something. So this self-knowledge itself is being called dharma. For this, which is dharma, means for this self-knowledge that is being discussed here. So people who have no shraddha in this, they have no shraddha in the Vedas, they have no shraddha in the teaching tradition. So for those people that have no Shraddha, hey, Parantapa. Parantapa is a vocative for Arjuna. It means the one who is a scorcher of his foes, the one who burns his enemies, because he's a warrior. So the one who's always who scorches his foes. So those people who don't have Shraddha, in fact, Shankara says something nice in his Bhasha. He goes, Ashraddha Dhanaha, that's the word. Then he goes, Shraddha Virahitaha, they're without Shraddha. That's how Bhasha works. It'll take the word, Ashraddha Dhanaha, and then he goes, Ashraddha Dhanaha, what does that mean? Shraddha Virahitaha. It means they are devoid of, they're without Shraddha. For what? Atma Jnanasya. They don't have Shraddha in this knowledge of the Atma. What is that? The Dharma. For this Dharma, Dharmasya Asya. For this Dharma, which is the knowledge of the Self, they have no Shraddha in that. And then it says, what does that mean to not have any Shraddha in Atma Jnana? He says, Swarupe Tetkalecha. They don't have any Shraddha in the Atma Swarupa, that there is even an Atma. They don't have, even though the Upanishads, the Vedas say there is an Atma, they don't have Shraddha. They don't take that seriously. And nor Tat Pala, nor do they take the Pala, which is Moksha, the Pala of that. They don't take that seriously either. They have no Shraddha in it. No interest, no Shraddha. So then he says, they are Gnosticas. Gnosticas are people who don't accept the Vedas. People who are called Astikas in the Vedic tradition, they accept the Vedas. Gnosticas are people that don't accept the Vedas. And so you have to think of it within the Hindu community, where the Vedas are the kind of the scriptural authority for those people. If within that culture, you know, there are people who reject that scripture, the Vedas, they're called Gnosticas. And Shankara says, they're Papa Karinaha. They're people who will be doing papas. And then he says, why? He says, why? Why do they have to be doing papas? Because good people, you know, just, you could be an atheist, for instance, and still a good person, have kind of a, you know, follow Dharma. You know, Swamiji even addresses that. He said, that's true, but in, you know, in that culture, if you're turning your back on that, what are your the Vedas, which are kind of the embodiment of Dharma in a sense, you're turning your back on that, then what are you going toward? And so he says, Shankara says, they're papakaris, you know, they're people who are, you know, are going to be doing papas. And then he goes, Asura na Upanishadam. For them, they have the Upanishad for the Asuras. The Asuras are, you know, like you have Rakshasas and Asuras, they're like the demons, the slothful ones. For what is the Upanishad for the Asuras? He says, Deha Matratma Darshanam. The Upanishad for the Asuras have this darshana. This is their vision. They see the Atma Deha Matram, only as the body. They see the Atma as only as the physical body, alone, eva, right? And so those people, having no Shraddha, they will, he says, aprapyamam. They can't attain me. They can't attain me. And here he's talking about the Satchidananda Atma. They can't attain me as who is Brahman. Why? Because they've already concluded that I am this physical body, and in fact, the self that they are is Brahman. Right? The self that they are is Brahman, but they have no Shraddha in this knowledge, no Shraddha in the Vedas, and they have following the Asura Upanishad, which says, which is like the Charvakas, which says, I'm just my body, you know? And then, let's see if he says anymore. Then he says, and that being the case, they definitely won't attain me because there's no pramana for them. There's no pramana for them, and they've already concluded that they are this body, and so do what they'll do what they need to do to be happy, right? To gain happiness. So So you can read what Swamiji says then. That's kind of interesting.
Materialists.
Yeah, materialists, right. Yeah. Yeah, he quotes one materialist who says something like, this body, this physical body, is going to die and go to dust. You know? And so do whatever you need to do to enjoy, to be happy. Because when you're dead, there's no fruits, in other words, he doesn't say exactly like this, but when you're dead, there's no karmapala. When you're dead, you're dead. So do whatever you want to do now to enjoy yourself. That's the Upanishad of the Asuras. Do whatever you do, you know, because there's no punishment. There's punya and papa. That's the Vedas. I don't accept any of that. When you're dead, you're dead. So enjoy yourself, whatever it takes. Don't worry about it. When you're dead, you're dead. It's over. That's what he quotes as kind of a famous quote like that. So this, remember, this is what do you call it when they're... he's just presenting a dark picture, right? He's presenting the dark side. So giving you the light side, how wonderful this knowledge is. Now, what happens? What happens, you know, for those people who have no Shraddha, you know, who don't gain this knowledge, then what happens for them? Definitely they don't gain me, because I am you, you know. Then they, nivartante can mean they return again and again and again. It can also mean they remain. The verb has these two meanings. So nivartante, let's take it, they remain. Mrityu samsara vartmani. Vartmani means on the path of samsara, which is mrityu yukta. In Sanskrit as well, Sanskrit students will learn, you can have, there's certain types of compounds that drop a word in the middle, the word is implied. And so here, mrityu samsara means, you're not going to say the samsara of mrityu or the samsara which is mrityu. It's the samsara itself which is associated with mrityu, which has mrityu. In samsara, the samsara which is just the cycle of change, right? Birth and death, birth and death, birth and death. So these people remain on this path of samsara, which has continual birth, death, birth, death, birth, death. Because how can they gain me? And, you know, I mean, once, even in the Taittiriya Upanishad, it says, you make a conclusion. Say if you have the conclusion that I am the body, you know, there is no God and I am this body. That is your conclusion. And so what is the, as long as that is your firm conclusion, say that's, you know, your dritta jnanam, that's your firm knowledge, then what is the situation for you? The situation for you is there's no God and I'm this body. And then there's not going to be any self-knowledge, right? Not at this time. The self-knowledge has already taken place. In your conclusion, the self-knowledge, it's mithyajnanam. Your self-knowledge is mithyajnanam. But that's where your firm conclusion is that there is no God and I'm this body. And so your life will be based upon that reality. There's no opening in you for anything else. That opening, in fact, is considered a punya. You know? Shraddha is a great punya. Shraddha is not just a simple belief. In terms of self-knowledge, Shraddha is that openness pending understanding. Right? For self-knowledge, you're already here. So it's something where the knowledge and the pala are immediate and direct. It's here itself right now. Shraddha in the first part of the Vedas is more of a belief. You believe in punya and papa. You believe that there are other lokas. You believe in the transmigration of the soul. You believe in the Dharma. You believe in the rituals. All of these things, even though having this, but it's a different kind of belief, actually. It's like an indirect knowledge because you have Shraddha in the veracity of the Vedas. Right? So it's called Shabda Pramana. You have Shraddha in the veracity of the Vedas. But you can't go to those other lokas. You're not reincarnating right now. Here you are. But once it's revealed, it also rings true to your mind. You know, what is revealed in the Vedas becomes the primary statement in an anumana, in a logical syllogism. And there's all kinds of logic and drishtantas and things that can support it. But none of our means of knowledge can actually give us that primary statement. You know, so the primary statement is a revealed knowledge. That's what we mean by belief. We ourselves can't come up with a primary statement. But once the primary statement is made and understood, then we experience that in the creation. Though we couldn't come up with that explanation of it. In Advaita Vedanta in the Upanishads, it is different. Because you are not away like a loka is away. You're not you're here fully. The satyam mitya is totally present. So that type of knowledge is different. It's aproksha-jnanam, it's a direct knowledge, right? But there's the shraddha, the shraddha is for the Vedas as a whole. That's what he's talking here. It's for the knowledge that's revealed in the Upanishads, you know? And then also for understanding the Dharma, you know? That is really passed down in every culture, actually, you know? You understand the Dharma, you understand Dharma here just by the experience of sticking your hand in the fire. You can understand Dharma here, you know? That if I'm kind to others, I have shanti. If I'm cruel to others, you know, I have stress. If I'm honest, I have shanti. If I lie, I have stress. All of these things, we go on learning and learning and become gaining more and more shanti. The Shastra will say, if you do live a dharmic life, the mind will gain shanti, enough shanti to make you self-reflective, which will make you into a mumukshi. That gaining that shanti will bring about the mumukshitvam because you have space. You have space to reflect, to ask, to question. You know, and so then you'll become a mumukshi. Then you have to get a teacher. The Bhagavan has to take care of that in one way or the other. So here, after now saying to Arjuna, it's a way of saying, because he's recognized Arjuna as a mumukshu, as a seeker, you know? And so he's unfolding now the greatness of this knowledge, and he's also saying what is a tremendous loss, you know, if that shraddha isn't here. So he's really putting Arjuna in a mental state, you know, to receive this knowledge. And now I'm going to stop it here, but now, in these next verses, he really gives the satyam mitya. This is really a beautiful chapter. Mm. Now he's really going to start teaching this knowledge, you know, from the standpoint of the whole. So, we'll do it next. Will I be here next week? Next week I'll be here.
You sure?
I will?
Yeah, because you'll be Friday. When are you going to date?
Oh, I'll be here Thursday.
Yeah, you have a seminar.
Yeah, I'll
Saturday.
Be here Thursday, yeah. 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 Then I'm going back to that wedding, right? I'm losing track of the weeks. But we'll have this class. We'll have this class, and then I'll go the next morning.
Purnamidam, Purnat, Purnamadachate, Purnasya, Purnamadaya, Purnameva Vashishate, Om Shanti Shanti Shanti, Hari Om Shri Guru Pyo Namaha, Hari Om.
Sudha's
actually, I don't remember reading that either, but it's right in there. Swami talks about it in his commentary also. But you know, but Shankara has a sense of humor too.
Yeah.
You know, he will say things like that. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Did he call it Asura Upanishad?
Yeah. Was it? Yeah, Asura Nam Upanishadam, the Upanishad of the Asuras.
Kara, can you say something about... It seems like it's kind of simple what you said, the truth of Satyam, but the teaching technology seems to be extremely complex. And so it's like, how do you navigate yourself through that? I mean, how do you hold that vision of how you, I mean, I know it's like, I'm sure it comes over the years and it's just kind of...
You mean for the teacher or the student?
Yeah, for you.
No, because...
It's like, what's your red thread there? It's through this labyrinth of complexity of priorities and prerequisites to teaching and unfolding this. It just seems like so complex.
It's not as complex as you think, because... First of all, you yourself are being exposed to that teaching methodology over and over and over and over and over again from so many different directions. Mm-hmm. Right? At some point, instead of it just pointing out the self to you, you actually start hearing how the steps that are involved. Initially, you don't hear the steps that are involved. You're just going along. It's just taking you along with it. But after some time, you start hearing the actual prakriya being unfolded. Okay, so that's one thing. You hear it over and over and over again. And then when somebody asks you, if you know, right, if you've gained this knowledge and you know what they need to hear before they can hear the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, Shankara uses this example that I like. Swamiji's talked about this. It's just kind of a different way of looking at it. He says, this knowledge for jnana nishtha, it has to be like an amalaka fruit in the palm of your hand. An amalaka fruit is just a little round fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put it on the palm of your hand, you see the whole thing. You see the whole. Right? And so if you see the whole, then, like, say, you know an apple. Say it's an apple, that amalaka fruit. Just that there's an apple in your hand. Now, you need to describe that apple to somebody. Now, how many ways can you describe it? There's really countless ways that you can describe it. It depends on how creative you are.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because you know the apple. The other person doesn't know the apple. The amount of descriptions are only going to be limited by your creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So Swamiji has said, and this is not just Swamiji, but it's an actual example that's used, you know, unfolding this knowledge is actually like an elephant trying to dance on a post. And the reason he says that is that an elephant is big and the post is small and it gets little hooves, you know? It's two little hooves on the post and trying to do a nice little dance. What they mean is the knowledge is you are that. Tatvamasi, you are that. You know, so that what needs to be unfolded, you have to take a person from mithya to satyam. You know, you have to take a person that's basically from their points of identification with the mithya to who they are. And there's certain, not even that many, but there's 5 or 6 major prakriyas, you know, to do that. And then there's all kinds of details. The details are the things that we experience in the creation. All those things and all those interrelationships and things that we experience in the creation have to be taken back to the satyam. You know, and so when a person has a doubt, then those two things. For one thing, you've heard all of these doubts. You've had your own doubts and you've heard them all because you've studied for a long time. All of the bhashas have all of these doubts and they always take from the doubt to the, you know, to the resolution. And so you've done that, so you've seen it so many times for a teacher. You've seen it so many times that and owned it so many times that you probably, I mean, not every student has every doubt, but if you've been in enough satsang and you've listened enough, there's a certain number of doubts that people have, and you've heard it many times and seen that pathway many, many times, you know.
But that's not the main thing. The main thing is you know who you are and you know what this is. And you can go from here to there.
Yeah.
You can go from metta to satyam.
But don't you also say that once you get this vision about oneself, then you have to be able to say, well, I'm free and I'm untouched, I'm Brahman. But then you have to be able to say, I'm Ishvara also. Mm-hmm. Isn't there another stage kind of?
Yeah. You have to see yourself and then you have to see yourself as the whole. In fact, until you see yourself as the whole, you don't really see yourself. Because if you don't see yourself as the whole, then you're like a little pea in a pod. This pure conscious being is stuck in this body you're set in. But if the self isn't stuck in anything, then, you know, it's free. And then what's the relationship between this and this? But this is the mitya. See, there's another thing to understand. I'm not trying to make it more simple than it is. It's both simple, and then you have to be exposed to the sampradaya, the teaching methodology, mm-hmm. which has made you see. And if it is that methodology has made you see, then, you know, if you take the time to study, you can make others see. Why I take the time to study is because the teacher made you see in the order, by clearing the order of doubts that you have. But students come up with doubts that you never thought of, right? You never had that particular doubt. Then another student comes up with that, and, oh, that's interesting. But that had not come to your mind. Yeah.
But this, you part, this part about understanding
Ishwara. It's not doesn't get in the way of the satyam mitya or Ishwara for you. But when you hear their doubt, you could probably answer it yourself, but you'd never heard it in that way.
And this part about understanding Ishvara, is that part of the teaching methodology too? Is it in the Upanishads or which? Where about?
It's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Everywhere.
Because it's not complete until you do that. So any Upanishad, any Prakarana Granth, it's got to take you there.
But it's not told like Sri Rudram's tells it. You know.
Well, Rudram is meant to really make you understand that Ishvara is everything. Even the fisherman, the water carrier, you know, the goat, the herdsman, the later he's the murderer, the thief, and all different kinds of thieves, different kinds of murderers, different types of horrible people, and different types, all different types of people, all different types of situations. My salutations to that one, because it's all Bhagavan. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes through, Rudram just goes through the whole creation, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really, in fact, being able to chant Rudram and to understand what it's saying, it's really wonderful, because it gives you that Ishvara Buddhi toward everything, mm-hmm. even toward the light and the dark, toward Dharma Adharma. Because a dharma also is Ishvara. There isn't anything that's away from Ishvara. You know? A dharma is going against the dharma, which has its own karmapala. Right? So it's the laws.
But it seems like the understanding of Ishvara, it's kind of in India the culture held it also.
Yeah.
So the familiarity that the people had was already established in a way.
Yeah, but you know, it's so thorough in India, so very beautiful. But it's not that other cultures don't have scriptures, that they don't worship, that they don't have a god that they worship. They have dharma. They have ritual, they have all of these things, and they have their own mystical teachings also, which we're, for the most part, not really familiar with what those are. So I won't make a statement about those things at all, because I don't know. But within the Vedas, I know, you know, I know what they have to say. But we do know, because most people haven't really gotten into whatever the kind of the mystical teachings are of different religions, unless you have, you know. But there is God. There is heaven and hell of some sort. You know, there's Dharma, and adharma, all of these things. There's values, there's worship, there's ritual, you know. It's part of the creation and many different forms of it. And after I'd studied Vedanta, then I went back to JTU, the Graduate Theological Institute, to get that degree. And then I sat down and I read the Bible. I read the Torah, the Jewish Bible, which I have a really beautiful copy of it. I read it from start to finish, and then I read the New Testament from start to finish. You know, and a lot of it, honestly, I couldn't relate to it. But there's a lot of places where a lot of it is story, you know, and it's just not a story. It's not a story that's compelling for me. But when I would be reading along, and then I would see things like, oh, that's what they're talking about there. That's what they're talking about there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you read any of the mystics, whether it doesn't matter whether it's the Jewish mystics or the Christian mystics or in Islam, the Sufis, just pick out any mystics. Even if they don't have self-knowledge, you know what they're talking about. Yeah, because this is the reality that is here. Mm-hmm. And so they're talking about that, and you know what they're talking about.
So there are glimpses there more, instead
absolutely.
Of complete knowledge.
I'm not making a judgment on whether they have complete knowledge or not, because we don't know what they hold in their that part of the tradition. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would have to go and find out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like, unless even for the Upanishads, people don't know. Even people in India, they don't know. They know they have Upanishads and they can read the Upanishads and kind of talk about them, but they don't really know what it is, or they haven't been exposed to the pramana. They know it's there. They'd know a lot more than somebody outside of the tradition would know. But what it really is and what it really means, they don't know unless they've deeply experienced it.
So I got another question, if I may ask you. You know, in terms of the Kamakanda, it seems like you can have this knowledge and you can still kind of live in your own illusion in terms of, I mean, well, I guess if you really have the complete knowledge, then you don't have an illusion. But then you can have a partial knowledge, let's say. And, for example, I just discovered recently that whenever my mind judges, it's a kind of an adharmic process, really. You know, whenever I judge somebody else with something, you know, it's like I invoke a separation between me and the other, which is kind of against satyam, really. It's kind of, so I mean, you can, in a way, it has that association. I kind of realize I'm actually going against where I want to go, you know, in terms of my understanding. So if my mind judges from some kind of conditioned place, I'm really not invoking Dharma, but I'm kind of invoking our Dharma. That's what I mean. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. Like Swamiji will talk about that, where it's not that you don't see clearly. You can't be afraid to see clearly, you know, what's happening. But there's being able to understand what's going on with a person to make a person do such and such versus casting a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
The judgment often means, I mean, if there is a judgment, it often means you haven't taken the time or had the inclination to really understand what's going on with that person,
mm-hmm.
to cause, you know, that type of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're understanding a person, that's not judging them, right? If you understand what's going on. Somebody's doing something that is really harmful, and it is really harmful. That's not a judgment. They're doing something that is really harmful. But then it doesn't have to be about judging them. You see, they're doing something very harmful. You can understand what's going on there and you might have to take appropriate action. That's also not judging.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. I think is very freeing. I think this is something so great about the way Swamiji teaches, at least the way he teaches in Pennsylvania now. Because you come to understand everybody has a reason for the way they are, everybody has a reason for what they do, but you don't have to get drawn into it. You know, you can say, okay, they have that reason, and I understand that. You know, it's that sort of pranam
thing.
So
you don't
know?
Have to become their teacher, their guru, or their therapist.
And you don't even have to get your mind in it. Right?
No, you don't. But your mind goes toward understanding rather than toward judging.
Mm-hmm.
And he's even, and I've been doing this too, especially now at school, and I'm doing that non-dual perspectives class and guiding a lot of meditations there. And one that I use that Swamiji's used often is this just about seeing the reason? Say there's a conflict between you and somebody, there's something negative happening between you and somebody, to see the different reasons that, you know,
mm-hmm.
this led to this, led to this, was because of that, and then you've ended up in this situation,
mm-hmm.
right? And that somehow takes it away, it gives it back to Ishvara, you know, and gives you a distance on the whole thing.
But, and also just like, I mean, in terms of, say, psychotherapy, where you do with the parents kind of thing, you know, because sometimes, I mean, I haven't done much psychotherapy, but I think there can be this kind of judging, you blame your parents, say,
mm-hmm.
But then after a while, if you have that more the perspective Swamiji gives, it gets expanded so much that you can't trace it back where all that came from.
No, because it's
an
audit.
Yeah, it's an audit. Right. So it's just, you just know that it's all Ishvara operating, but you...
That's what ends up.
Yeah.
The whole thing ends up being...
Including your
Ishvara.
Own stuff about it.
Yeah, the whole thing. And even you feel the way you do because of this and because of that. The whole thing gets given over. Dissipates the complex. Yeah. Dissipates the pain, spreads it out into the situation, and then you know.
But how does psychotherapy really dissolve that beside just giving validation to the process?
Oh, how does it dissolve it?
Yeah, how does...
Nothing really takes it. Nothing's going to dissolve the problem completely if that's the problem that's built on ignorance, you know.
Right.
But it can relatively resolve things.
You can smoothen it.
Absolutely. I mean, people can have relative shanti and relative peace, you know, relative well-being. You know, some people are happier than others, right? They enjoy much more peace than others.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Because they have dharma, and they have a way of learning how to be with others and how to be with their own mind.
Mm-hmm.
But they still can't resolve the whole thing into, you know, a self where they can just relax. Relax there, but still. And in fact, a lot of the things that we teach in this class, or Swamiji teaches, it's all backed by knowledge. But there's a lot of tools that we have for how to be with our mind. The thing is that we have the whole self, the self and the knowledge to hold those tools, so it goes a little bit, the resolution is a little deeper. But we still have those tools, like the inner child work and things like
mm-hmm.
that. And these meditations for resolving, you know, hatred and negative relationships with people. We have all of these kind of tools. But for us, they get rid of pain that is being held by the self. You know, there's always that deeper level. That's what we're doing. That's what I'm doing anyway. Okay.
So the inner friend, is that coming out of you, out of the sampradaya, or is this a kind of a psycho-emotional sampradaya integration piece that you discovered, you know, the whole concept of, because you related to that so many times, the inner friend, it seems like a really useful tool. That's what I discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Well, I learned it from Swamiji in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't use those words, but I learned it. That's what I learned, and it changed my life completely.
Mm-hmm.
Changed everything. But the whole way, my whole internal structure changed with that understanding. So that's what I was teaching, because it's so important to me.
Mm-hmm.
And even there's that verse that you mentioned one time about where Shankara, or maybe Krishna says even that your inability to have patience with that and inability to...
Yeah, Shankara talks about that in the Bhasha and the Gita. I forget which verse, which chapter that's in. I think it's actually, it may be in the second chapter near the end, or the third chapter. I could look through and find it.
Because you know how it seems to me, I mean, you've spoken about these kshayas sometimes.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that, and so I've even heard someone just say this, that, you know, he's pulled this something out of the Upanishad, which might be small, and he's expanded it. Because we need it now.
Yeah.
So these orders of Ishvara and the psychological order, and it's in there.
Definitely in there. Even the pramanas.
Mm-hmm.
Pramanas throughout. Mm-hmm. But Swamiji never saw that until he was taught. And now, but that made everything come together for him.
Right.
He'd read all the Upanishads backwards and forwards, all of the bhashas. He did not understand pramana
right.
until he was exposed to it. And then when he went back, he said, they're everywhere.
But I mean, in terms of the psychological work, like, this is my theory, maybe I've heard him say something like this, maybe, where, like, nowadays, because of the way that we are, we need more of this psychological work, and so in the Upanishads, he saw that, although it wasn't highlighted, per se.
And yeah, I'm sure that's true.
He brought it out into these orders of Ishvara, highlighting that psychological order.
I said that in one of our interviews.
I don't understand that the pranama.
Pramana.
Pramana.
Pramana is the teaching methodology.
But how did he discover that after he studied all the Upanishads?
Well, he hadn't. Because he was studying for a while and not understanding anything. He was studying at all and meditating,
uh-huh.
but it didn't make sense, because there was how he was studying it was like you study the Upanishads and then you go and realize it. That's how it's often taught, actually. You study the Upanishads, you study the teaching, and then you go try to understand, realize it. And that's not using the Upanishads as a pramana. And so it was like he was ready, I think he actually did, didn't he throw out all his books, burn all his books and everything, he just released, all these books are useless, he got rid of his whole library, and he was just going to go. He said he lost his hair trying to meditating so long. And then he saw that one teacher who just made it all come together. And then he understood what the Upanishads were. Then he saw it everywhere as he read through the Upanishads. It was obvious. But you have to be taught, you know. Anyway.
Was that when he studied with Chinmayananda?
Well, Chinmayananda didn't really use the... He didn't use the Vedanta as a pramana.
Hmm.
You know, so that hadn't been made clear to him. He was a very dynamic speaker, though.
Hmm.
You know, but that pramana was not used by him.
Hmm.
So Swamiji actually brought that into the Chinmaya mission. He brought that into the mission. So, that understanding.
I think the name of the Swami he studied with who showed him that was named Pranavananda.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah. Let's stop. I have to go.